Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The story of Texas prior to the Keystone 1836 battles of the Alamo and San Jacinto has not received much mainstream attention. Historian Sam W. Haynes has focused his research on 19th century Texas to present a new interpretation of the founding of Texas. He wrote about this in his 2022 book, Unsettled Land, From Revolution to Republic, The Struggle for Texas. Prior to the Texas Revolution, the region was one of the most racially diverse in North America. And though some of the usual suspects like Sam Houston and William Barrett Travis play a part, Haynes's book goes wider to explore how Mexicans, Native Americans, and Black Texans navigated 19th century turmoil. Haynes's research has led him to develop a map that analyzes sites of interracial violence in Texas in the 19th century. The map documents nearly 3,000 sites of conflict. He says it's a way to better understand the beginnings of modern Texas. Haynes explains where his interest in this chapter of the Texas story began.
So I had been thinking about writing a book on the early 19th century in Texas for quite some time. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to focus on Native Americans, not just the Anglo-American experience, of course, which many of us know so well, having taken seventh grade Texas history, but Native Americans, about 30 or 40% of the population at the time of the Texas Revolution, for example, and they're really not part of that story. So one of the things that I wanted to do, of many, I had several objectives, but I knew that I wanted to tell the Native American story and weave it into that familiar traditional narrative. But I had read everything that there was to read on Native Americans in Texas, and I still didn't really understand it. And the reason for that is because it is just so complicated. There are at least 20 tribes in Texas in the 1820s and the 1830s, and they are unique. They're culturally distinct, and they're constantly moving. Everyone knows the difference between nomadic and sedentary tribes, but even the sedentary tribes very often are moving from one place to another. And I would argue that you simply can't understand Native Americans without looking at it spatially, looking at them spatially. So before I started writing Unsettled Land, I began work on this digital humanities project, which we put online, where we mapped Native American groups and their conflict with settlers, not just Anglo-American settlers, but Mexican Texans as well. And that's really what we did initially. And it helped me a lot to understand, say, Comanche raiding patterns, for example, or Shawnee ideas of territoriality. And so the first phase of the project was really helpful in helping me to weave that story into that traditional narrative. And then when the book came out in 22, and about by 2023, we started rethinking the website, which is now called Texas in Turmoil, Mapping Interethnic Violence, 1821 to 1879. And we expanded the project, taking it all the way up into the 1870s, sort of the end of the Indian Wars, also the end of Reconstruction. And we have about 3,000 data points that we map and that we analyze to try to understand interethnic conflict in Texas. So the book and the website came to be at roughly the same time. And they both are part of the same goal, and that is to understand this extraordinarily diverse place that we call Texas. It's important to remember that Texas is one of the most ethnically diverse regions on the North American continent in the early decades of the 19th century. And so the book and the website both try to get people to understand that we really need to broaden our scope if we want to understand that the story of the birth of early modern Texas.
You talked a little bit about the span of the years, 1821 to 1879. Can you talk again about why you chose that particular window in time?
So 1821, the year of Mexican independence. It's also the year that Anglo-Americans with Stephen of Austin begin to come to Texas, some of them bringing enslaved people with them. And in the 1820s, we begin to have better records of violence between native groups and Mexican and Anglo settlers. So 1821 seemed like a good place to start. 1879, the end of the Indian Wars, and Reconstruction is over in Texas by that time. And I think there's another question to ask, in addition to why did you choose those years? And that is, why just focus on interethnic or interracial violence? And the answer to that question is because within that time frame, there really isn't anything else. It's almost all interethnic or interracial. It's important to remember that these are very small, tightly knit communities, and they tend to react very aggressively toward others. Now, by the 70s, as the communities and towns in Texas begin to get larger, you do see more white-on-white violence, more black-on-black violence, and so on. Bar fights, crimes of passion, ranchers stringing up cattle rustlers, as we've all seen in Westerns. But I would say 95% of the violence that we see in Texas over more than half a century, this particular half century, is really interethnic or interracial. So that's what we wanted to focus on.
Well, I want to say that when you do open this Texas in Turmoil website, the first image or one of the first images that you encounter is a map of modern day Texas. And that map is almost completely covered in sort of these color coded dots. And each of those dots is an example or one of many examples of various interethnic conflicts. And I would like for you to maybe talk to us about the work that went into finding out more about these individual episodes and about actually creating these maps and these really fascinating charts that go along with this map.
I think I want to start by saying that the study of history has changed a lot in the last couple of decades. The kinds of things that we can do online, the kind of learning tools that we can develop online, are so important than just simply the texts that historians used to do. I mean, we write books. I still write books. But it's been really rewarding to develop a website where first-time visitors, even people who do not know much about the story of Texas or the story of Native Americans or Mexican Americans or what have you. And it's a fairly easy site, I would like to think. It's an easy site to navigate, and it's pretty intuitive. And if you are interested in learning about the violence in a particular county, say Bexar County, during a particular time period, then you can go to the map, and there's a navigation bar with a drop-down menu, which will allow you to do that. And if you want to focus on Bexar County in a particular time period and you want to look at violence involving African Americans, you can do that too, because we have a drop-down menu for each racial category. When we started, I would have to say that we were using memoirs. Most of the memoirs were written by Anglo-Americans in the 1820s. We used some Mexican archives as well, the Laredo archives and the Bexar archives. But we relied pretty heavily on firsthand accounts of settlers who came with Stephen F. Austin and who encountered Karankawa Indians along the coast, for example. And as time went on and we read everything we could find, we began to sort of drill down deeper and start looking at primary source materials. I had students, both undergraduate and graduate students, that read every newspaper that has been published in Texas from the 1820s to the 1870s. They've all been digitized, or the vast majority have been digitized on the Portal for Texas History. And that was a terrific resource. But by the time we got into the 1860s and 70s, and we were looking in the last phase of the project at violence involving African Americans. Then we started looking at the National Archives and the Freedmen's Bureau reports. And I had some terrific students who combed through those as well. And that was a gold mine of information. And so the amount of research involved and the number of people who were involved in that research is really pretty remarkable, I would have to say. There were a lot of people involved, and they did a lot of reading and a lot of research. And so we're very proud of the finished product. If you look at each event, if you click on one of those dots, then a box will open, and you'll have a very brief description, tell you what county it's in, tell you who's involved, give you the names, if we know them, of the individuals involved. And then it'll also have very extensive citations.
And again, we call it a mapping project, but it's not just a map, because I'm looking at the site right now. You when you scroll down it, it really is a beautifully illustrated narrative. I can see how this project did go hand in hand with your book, Unsettled Land, because a lot of the stuff that I've read in the book, I am seeing also on this particular website. And you've also sort of categorized it in chapters almost: early conflict, independence, when Texas was a republic, when Texas was annexed. You break things down into these categories that really kind of give you this broader view, again, of early Texas history and the diversity that was in the state.
If you go to the Texas in Turmoil site, the first thing you go to is a landing page which has a rather long narrative that I wrote on interethnic violence in Texas, and using some of the images from Unsettled Land, others as well. So I think it's an important story. And for first-time visitors, I hope that they will take the time to read that narrative, because, you know, if you remember your Texas history, I mean, we tend to sort of compartmentalize events. We know if we've lived in Texas, if we grew up in Texas, then we took Texas history, or we know something about it. We all know about the Texas Revolution. And then maybe we know about Native American conflict, but we compartmentalize those things. And I'll just give you an example. When you think about the Texas Revolution, that is a story involving Anglo-Americans and Mexican Texans and the Mexican government, of course. But we forget that there are Native American groups doing all kinds of things at exactly the same time. And I'll give you an example. Battle of San Jacinto, as we know, is in April 21st, 1836. Only a few weeks later, Comanches and Wichitas attack Fort Parker in Limestone County. And we have sort of separated these stories, in part because they're incredibly complex and it's hard to tell all of these stories at the same time. But we need to, because they're happening at exactly the same time. Comanche raiding is beginning to pick up steam in the mid-1830s, just as the Texas Revolution is occurring. And so to just simply say, well, we'll get to Cynthia Ann Parker and we'll talk about that story, that famous story, later, I think is the wrong approach. We need, as hard as it is, we need to understand that so much is going on in Texas all at the same time. And also, I would say, the narrative tries to make clear, and certainly the map does, if the narrative on the landing page doesn't, is that these are all multi-generational conflicts. The Native American conflicts involving Anglo settlers, these continue for decades. The conflicts between Anglo settlers and Tejanos, that too is a multi-generational conflict that needs, I think, more study. I think most people think that after 1836, or certainly after the U.S.-Mexico War, those conflicts came to an end. But throughout the 40s, throughout the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, the Trans-Nueces, the land between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande, is a hotbed of racial conflict. And so the map tries to make that clear as well.
Sam W. Haynes is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Greater Southwestern Studies at the University of Texas at Arlington. He's the author of Unsettled Land, From Revolution to Republic, The Struggle for Texas. When we come back, the story of what's now modern Texas began not with the Anglo-centric Battle of the Alamo, but with a diverse population from across the continent.
This is a place of convergence, so it is diverse. And you would expect that diversity to lead to conflict. And guess what? It does.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
The thought of getting rid of a vehicle you love but no longer need can conjure up mixed feelings. So many great memories of road trips, vacations, and special moments. But you're not really using it anymore, and it's kind of taking up space. Here's a thought. Donate it. Proceeds support Texas Public Radio, and you'll give it a new life of supporting the programs you love. Go to tpr.careasy.org to learn more today.
Welcome to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The interactive digital mapping project Texas in Turmoil reveals where interethnic violence occurred in 19th century Texas between 1821 and 1879. In that short period, historian Sam W. Haynes and his team with the Center for Greater Southwestern Studies at the University of Texas at Arlington pinpointed nearly 3,000 sites of conflict that claimed over 9,500 lives across all corners of Texas and points in between. One random click on a point near San Antonio reveals information on a freedman, an unidentified black soldier, killed in San Antonio in 1876 by a white policeman. Further south, a click on a point near Brownsville brings up the 1875 hanging of four presumed Mexican cattle thieves, and a random click near El Paso unveils information on the 1877 Texas Ranger killing of an Indian and Hispano, as they're described, for allegedly attempting to escape their arrest for arms possession. The project is not just points on a map. The website that houses the map offers a broad synopsis of what was happening in Texas among ethnic Mexicans, Anglos, Native peoples, and Black Texans during those five decades. It's a visually engaging trip through chapters of Texas history that don't often get told in the wider context of the Texas story. Haynes, a historian, says he was often shocked about what he discovered while working on the project.
One of the things that did surprise me was that after the Civil War, the violence against African Americans is amazing. I mean, it starts in the summer of 1865 and it goes on at least until 1869 and into the 1870s. I think we need to do more in the 1870s. We're not actually finished with this project, by the way. And I think there's more work to be done, but certainly we found, the Texas in Turmoil Project found, about twice as many African-American fatalities as had previously been reported. The problem was so serious that the Texas legislature convened a committee to look into violence against freed men and women and came up with a number. It was in the 300s. I can't remember the exact number now. And we found about twice that many by going through newspapers, diaries, and particularly the Freedmen's Bureau reports. So when we think about Juneteenth, and as Texans, we all know about Juneteenth, the emancipation of Texas slaves, and that's very often the headline, but the headline, I think, should be accompanied with a caveat, and that is that after Juneteenth, there was widespread violence against the formerly enslaved.
Would you say that there's an undercount of what you've categorized in your Texas in Turmoil project? Because I think it's pretty well understood that not all killings or reports of violence were right. Reported in newspapers or written about, you know, by coroners.
That's right. And we have been very, very careful with our data. One of the things that I did not want to do was to inflate these numbers to make a point. People's memories fail them, and sometimes they come up with all kinds of crazy numbers that we felt that we had to fact check multiple times. I'd rather undercount, actually, than overcount, to be honest. I want to be sure of the data that we have in the project. I mean, if I can be a little bit, get specific here, after the Freedmen's Bureau offices close in the late 1860s, then we find that violence against African Americans, the data drops off very, very quickly. And so we are in the process of going county by county see if we can't find more that sort of escaped the sort of the public's attention. We may find things, we may not. But I think after the Freedmen's Bureau offices close, then the mechanism by which that data is collected ceases to function. So my guess is that in the 1870s, there are more, and we are now looking for ways to corroborate that.
Well, going back to your original interest in talking about how Native Americans and the role that they played in the early formation of Texas, you mentioned at the beginning of the program that there were at least 20 tribes that were moving in and out of Texas. And if you look at what are the federally recognized tribes in Texas, there are now only three: the Alabama Coushatta, the Kickapoos, and the Isletas. But there are still tribes here in Texas. So I'm wondering if maybe you feel there's more of their story still to tell?
There is, certainly. I think one of the areas that needs more work is intertribal conflict, because the only evidence we have of intertribal conflict is when Anglo settlers refer to, there were short, rather brief wars between the Cherokees and the Wichitas, for example, in the late 30s and the 1840s. And we only have Anglo settlers' accounts of that. And so our intertribal conflict, the data that we have on the conflict between these tribes, I would love to be able to find more. And we, you know, we'll continue to add to the site as we find things. But it's pretty well known. I mean, there's a conflict between the Comanches and the Tonkawas, the Comanches and the Shawnees as well. And we have a few data points that point to that, but not as much as there probably were, because that conflict, the Tonkawas and the Shawnees were fighting Comanches for 15 to 20 years. So there's probably more than we have there. So yes, the story is, you know, evolving as we find more data. But I think we put it up now because we at least have enough data to make certain, to draw certain conclusions. And I think if you look, even a first-time user takes a look at the site, looks at Native Americans, one of the most important things they can learn is how different these tribes were. So some tribes, and I should add, a very few tribes, raided prodigiously, like the Comanches, for example. If you look at Comanche raiding patterns, then you find Comanches raiding throughout the state in choosing different targets as time goes on, but raiding nonetheless. Whereas the Shawnee, for example, all the conflict involving Shawnees are the area that they occupied just below the Red River. They were very territorial. They stayed there. They weren't in conflict with anyone until Anglo surveyors and settlers began to move into the area after the Texas Revolution. And then for several years, there was conflict. But these tribes are all different. And you can learn that. You can see that in the way they interact with Mexican Texans and Anglo Texans in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s.
Well, it's kind of been a very unusual time to be a historian in Texas. Many have gotten some blowback for example, just a few years ago, there was a book out by some historians who shone a light on the fact that slavery played a big part in Texas independence, and some state officials, even now, are not very welcoming to a broader vision of what the story of Texas is. So I'm wondering if you have gotten any blowback yourself after Unsettled Land was published in 2022, or if you're still feeling that today, if you have felt it.
Well, sure. I mean, there has been blowback, probably not as much as the book that you're referencing, Forget the Alamo.
That's the one.
But I think this idea that I mentioned already, that Texas is a very, very diverse place, and phenomenally so. I mean, we need to think about Texas. When I teach Texas history to my students at UT Arlington, I try to sort of present it as this place of convergence. There are people coming from all over the continent to Texas. There are Mexicans, of course, who are coming north. Comanches who are coming in from the Northwest, Apaches from the far West, Anglo-Americans and enslaved people coming in from the United States. We have several Native American groups in the United States that are also coming here as well. And that's not even including the Europeans who come, you know, by after the revolution. So this is a place of convergence. So it is diverse. And you would expect that diversity to lead to conflict. And guess what? It does. And that's something that we need to reckon with. And I am very disappointed, quite frankly, that the Alamo has become, you know, another sort of a battlefield for our divided sort of partisan times. It seems to me almost beyond debate that the Alamo, which was a mission established to minister to Cuiltec and Indian bands in the early 1700s, it borders on the bizarre that we are just going to focus on a 13-day siege in 1836. We have to sort of embrace this idea that Texas was a diverse place then. And sometimes there are accusations of wokeness lodged at historians who try to take a revisionist approach. And one of my responses when I'm asked questions like that is that, well, we are not changing the narrative because of the diversity of Texas now, which is, I think, what some people assume. We're changing the narrative because of the diversity of Texas then. It was always diverse, and there was always interethnic and interracial conflict. That's the story that we're trying to tell. Do you just want to focus on the Alamo defenders? Well, apparently some people do. But if you do that, then you have to acknowledge that you are writing out of that story large groups of people. Anglo-Americans are not the majority in Texas at the time of the Revolution. People of color are. And so my response is, do you want to talk about these people or not? It seems like a no-brainer to me that you need to take all of these different groups into account and to make them part of the discussion. And to go back to your comment about blowback, I speak to civic groups all the time. And sometimes they may be conservative civic groups. And I find that generally, no, I wouldn't say generally, always, invariably, people want to have a dialogue and they want to be, they want a discussion. And if it's an intelligent discussion and it's not insulting, then I find that those discussions can take place. I love speaking to civic groups because I want to have, this is the kind of conversation that I want to have. This is what Unsettled Land does. This is what Texas in Turmoil does. It's an important discussion, and I don't think we're doing enough of that, quite frankly.
And I have to say, you know, when I started reading Unsettled Land, I was hooked from the first page. And it's got to be maybe difficult to tell students that, okay, you're going to be learning Texas history, and it's going to be interesting, I promise, because you're giving it sort of this different take that I think that so many more young people out there can relate to. So I'm wondering what the reaction is from your students when they take your courses.
Well, not just my students. I've been asked to give virtual lectures to universities around the state since the book came out. And those have all been a lot of fun. I gave one last week at the University of Houston. And for the kids who remember their seventh grade history, they just can't imagine the story being told any other way. And I don't know if there are any other narratives, certainly not in Texas, but nationwide, that historical narratives that seem to be as set in stone, as calcified, if you will, as the narrative of the Texas Revolution. People are absolutely convinced that it happened a particular way, and it seems almost completely immune to challenge. But it can be done, I think. To talk about Unsettled Land for just a second, on the first page, I begin with some settlers who are in North Carolina, and they are moving west. And I think that the reader will automatically assume that those settlers are Anglo-Americans, or perhaps they're Scots-Irish, but they are white and they are moving out into the frontier because that's what Americans did. and you don't learn until a page or two later that, in fact, these are Native Americans. This is a Native American village, which is not being forced off their homes. They have ceded their lands, and they are voluntarily moving west. This is before the Trail of Tears. This is in 1811, I believe. And that Cherokee band eventually makes its way down into Texas. And they are there before Stephen of Austin is. And more Cherokees arrive, and other tribes from the United States arrive. And in the 1820s, there are more Native Americans from the United States in Texas than Anglo-Americans. Now, in 1830, the Anglo-immigration skyrockets. And I think at that point, there are more Anglo-Americans than Native Americans. But Stephen F. Austin is not the first American to come to Texas. There are Native American groups that have been coming in for quite some time before he brings in the old 300. So if you start there, it becomes clear that, oh, well, you know, that traditional narrative has got some problems. And I think, you know, hopefully people will keep an open mind.
Sam W. Haynes is a professor of history and director of the Center for Greater Southwestern Studies at the University of Texas at Arlington. Haynes is the author of Unsettled Land, From Revolution to Republic, The Struggle for Texas. His Center for Greater Southwestern Studies has created the interactive digital mapping project Texas in Turmoil, Mapping Interethnic Violence 1821 to 1879. Explore the 3,000 points of interracial conflict and violence and read more about the early modern past of Texas at tpr.org. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.